is 02-1599 CR, State v. Peter R. Martell. Arguing for the defendant, Mr. Martell, is Stephen Zaleski. And then we will have Jeffrey Cassell, who is Assistant Attorney General, and you get 5 minutes of rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you.
Chief?
Yes.
Is this being recorded?
Pardon me?
Is it being recorded?
Well, we're going to see in a moment. Thank you for calling that to my attention. Ms. Nodolf, is the recording system on?
Yes, it
is. Okay, you may proceed.
Okay, good morning. My name is Stephen Zaleski, and I represent Peter Martell, the defendant appellant in this case. The first issue I'd like to address with the court is the issue of whether the general probation statute 973.09 provided the trial court in the case with the authority to order Mr. Martell to register under the sex offender statute 301.45. In its certification, the Court of Appeals suggests that the case is Hain and Oakley stand for the proposition that the general probation statute allows a court to impose virtually any condition of probation that's reasonable and appropriate unless the condition of probation is specifically or expressly limited by another statute. And the court goes on to suggest that perhaps the Torpin case is inconsistent with that proposition. Well, in my brief and today, I will argue that the sex offender statute 301.45 and the related statute 973.048 do expressly and specifically limit the court's authority under the general probation statute, and that therefore the trial court's order fails under the Hain or Oakley analysis. And I'll discuss those limitations further in my argument, but before I do, I'd like to first touch on the Hain and Oakley cases and suggest that perhaps the standard or proposition that was framed by the Court of Appeals is not necessarily properly drawn from the Hain and Oakley cases.
Mr. Zaleski, before you get into that, I was just looking at the probation statute itself at 973.09. And it strikes me that it's very broad. It talks about the fact that the court may impose any conditions which appear to be reasonable and appropriate. Now, it's my understanding in this particular situation, the court said that your client had to register as a sex offender. And the court said that it reached that conclusion because it was concerned about protecting the needs of the public. It felt that it was appropriate to do so because there had been, if I remember correctly, 6 read-in offenses tied to charges of sexual assault. Under those circumstances, aren't these conditions, the condition that he register as a sex offender, reasonable and appropriate as the statute talks about?
Well, I would draw the distinction between what's reasonable and appropriate perhaps based on a factual scenario and what's reasonable and appropriate based on what the law and the statutes say. And I think when we look at what's reasonable and appropriate based on what the applicable law is, it wasn't reasonable and appropriate. So I would draw the distinction between the factual scenario underlying Mr. Martell's situation, which arguably would call for that, and certainly had he been convicted of those offenses, then he'd have to register. But when you look at what the black letter of the law says, it's not reasonable and appropriate in view of the statutes that I'll address. And
are you relying for that conclusion on the Oakley case? Is that the basis for your argument?
Well, I think under Oakley and Hain and under the Torpin analysis, the trial court's order fails. So irrespective of what analysis we would adopt, and I would argue that Hain and Oakley do not stand for the proposition that the Court of Appeals is suggesting that they do, the trial court's order fails.
I just want to
mention or ask you about the effect of a read-in. What is your argument as far as a read-in? Here there were six of them, and what effect that has on this particular issue?
Well, in terms of the read-in itself, the law provides that the defendant admits to that conduct. He specifically admits to the offense.
But the conduct, just so I understand, the conduct is admitted to via the read-in, which is consented to by your client. Is that?
That's what the law says. That's correct. That would be correct. And I will address in greater detail my position on the read-in aspect of this case further on in my argument.
Counsel, I guess we're not letting you get to what you want to address, but let me start as a threshold. I'm having difficulty putting this in an analytical framework or knowing which one to put it in. If I start with, as you did at your very first comments this morning, with the general probation statute, and then say anything can be a condition of probation unless it is expressly or specifically limited, and that's where you were starting your comment today. Then in my framework, I say, okay, then show me where it is expressly or specifically limited. And generally, when I think of expressly or specifically, I think of you shall not do this specific thing. So that's one framework. Another framework that evolves from this discussion in the briefs is I look at the general probation statute, and much like Justice Crooks mentioned, that you can have a condition as long as it's reasonable or appropriate. With this framework of analysis, I say, well, it's not appropriate if it's not lawful. Thus, I get to a threshold question of whether or not you can have as a condition of probation sex registration based on a read-in. That's a different, there are two different frameworks of analysis. Are you employing, apparently you're employing the specific and express because you started talking about that. Are you employing the other? Are they exclusive? Assist me with that if you will. If you understand my two different approaches, or do you understand that?
Well, I would say that there are certainly specific and express limitations in the sex offender registration statute, which would then go to the Hayne and Oakley case and support the argument here that there are express specific limitations on the court's authority under the general probation statute. And I do discuss those in my brief, and I'll point those out to the court. But I do agree with the court in terms of, you know, what may constitute an express specific limitation. Is it a sentence that says a trial court shall not or is specifically prohibited? And I think that those provisions are extremely rare in terms of the law and in terms of all of the statutes. I think the standard in this case, and I was getting to that in terms of framing the analysis, is not the nature of the limitations, but rather whether the competing statute usurps or abridges or restricts the general statute. And I think that's the analysis. And if it does, then the general probation statute does not allow the trial court to do that. Otherwise, the trial court could completely evade the more specific and restrictive statute by relying on the more general statute, the general probation statute. For instance, in terms of 973.048, it specifically requires a trial court to make findings of fact before placing or ordering a person to register. Those findings of fact would be that the conduct was sexually motivated and that it's in the interest of public protection. Now, if a court did not have to make those findings of fact, then or if a court could order registration just based on the registration or the general probation statute, it would not have to make those findings of fact. Similarly, under that same...
I don't quite understand that argument. The court here, the trial court, circuit judge, did make findings of fact as to why he was using this particular registration in this case, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, so that at least that was done.
Well, that's correct. I'm just using this statute for the example of a specific and express limitation. And I think it does limit the trial court's ability to order registration in terms of it requires the trial court to make that specific finding of fact. And if the trial court doesn't, then the trial court can't, under that statute, order registration. Now, if a trial court wanted to get around it, it could simply say, well, I'll order registration as a reasonable and appropriate condition of probation, which would render this specific statute meaningless. A trial court could easily get around it by doing that. In fact, a trial court could easily get around the other limitations in the registration statute by doing exactly that, saying, well, I'm not going to operate under the specific statutes in the registration statute, but I'm going to order registration based on this general probation statute, 973.09. That way I'm not limited or restricted by the contours of the registration statute. I think it's reasonable and appropriate, which is a very broad standard. It's very difficult to argue that it's not factually reasonable and appropriate, but the trial court can completely evade the specific limitations based on the registration statute, and I think that's the problem. Arguably, a trial court could order a person to register as a sex offender for whatever time it wanted under that standard, whether it's reasonable and appropriate. Again, the specific sex offender statute places limits on registration, places limits on various other items pertaining to our registration. And if a trial court could...
What did the trial court intend here? Did it intend to impose everything that is in these registration statutes?
Well, I can't speak to specifically what the trial court
did. What did the trial court say?
The trial court felt that it was reasonable and appropriate to order Mr. Martel, in this case, to register as a sex offender.
Under
the general probation statute.
Did it make reference to the sex registry statutes?
Actually, I think the trial court made the specific point of disavowing the specific registration statute and said that the issue is whether or not he falls under the registration statute. The issue is whether I, as a trial court, have the general authority to order him to register as a condition of probation. And I think the trial court framed that very issue. And so the trial court really disavowed the specific parameters of the registration statute.
But the trial court didn't set up its own registry.
No.
So the trial court intended that, I assume, that it would conform with the registry provisions in the statute.
Well, I guess the problem with that may be appropriate in this particular case, but under the argument that the state would be advancing, that a trial court can order registration simply as a reasonable appropriate condition, under that analysis, a person convicted of shoplifting or an OWI could be ordered to register as a sex offender, just so long as the trial court felt that it was reasonable and appropriate.
Well, let's take the case you just presented. Suppose there was a shoplifter, and suppose the trial court said, well, I want everybody in town to know that you're a shoplifter, so they watch for you and make sure they watch what you do. And so I'm going to set up a shoplifter registry, and you're going to sign it, and I'm then going to send notices along with your photograph to every shop in town. It'll be just like the sex registry, or I'm going to add my own things. And if you violate this condition of probation, then you are subject to all of the problems that you get into for violating condition of probation, right? What's the matter with that? One, there is no statute that says only shoplifters do this. In fact, there's no statute that limits the judge or explains to the judge what to do. And maybe it's reasonable and appropriate to label this person that way. And you keep him from being tempted because he or she knows that everybody's watching.
Well, I think the difference is that we have a very, very detailed, specific, and precise statute in this case, the sex offender registration statute, which goes to great lengths in terms of enumerating the criteria for
registration. So your argument is that the legislature has preempted the concept of sex offender registry, and the court either adheres to that, and that's it, cannot somehow adopt its own registry system.
That would be correct. The legislature has specifically defined who is covered. That's one of the provisions of the statute, who is covered under the registration statute. And it's a very, very detailed, very specific list. Now, if a trial court could say, well, he's not on this list, but I think he should be, and so I'm going to order him to register as a reasonable, appropriate condition of a probation.
973-041-M says that if a court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation for any violation under chapters 944 and 948 or sections 943-01 to 943-15, do we fall under that?
Actually, in this case, we do not fall under those.
Not.
Because the offense does not fall under that statute, I don't believe. I believe I would agree with the state in terms of saying that the offense falls under the companion to that subsection 2M, and that it's a sex offense. I believe, Your Honor, that...
Okay, we'll go to 2M. If a court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation for a violation of 940.22 and then a list, right?
Right.
You fall under 2M, but was this a minor? Yes. So you're within that. So why can't you do the registry under 973-048? That's reporting requirements.
Well, because he wasn't convicted of that offense.
It doesn't say convicted. It says violation.
Right.
And you said to Justice Wilcox that...
That was the reason for my question, Justice.
Right.
Okay.
You said to Justice Wilcox that it's an admission that he violated one of these statutes.
Right. Well,
so, it looks to me, under the language, you've got to now come out from under that. How do you come out from under it?
Actually, Your Honor, I think I said that he admitted the conduct. He admitted the conduct. Now, I think this,
okay.
The registration statute frames what constitutes a violation in terms of a conviction, an adjudication, a finding of not guilty by reason of a defect.
You've moved from, maybe I've missed it, but you moved just now from 973-048 to 301-45.
Well, that's correct in terms of...
Because I don't see conviction in here, but I may not have read it carefully enough.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. 973.048 does not speak to
conviction.
The more,
what about sub
the more
five?
Detail.
What about sub 5 of that?
Five.
Sub.
If the conviction in which the order is based.
You know, I believe that this statute looks towards 301.45. This statute, 973.048, cannot be read... in its own capacity, it clearly refers back to the registration statute. And that statute specifically frames what constitutes a violation in terms of a conviction,
well, 2M
an adjudication.
Well, 2M refers to 301.45. So let's look at 301.45. Now, under 301.45, when I looked at it, it uses the word violation, too, also, I should say. It says, under 301.45, definitions. And it talks about violation, but there it says convicted or found not guilty of a violation comparable to a sex offense. And then when it talks about who was covered under 1G, it talks about convictions. Right?
Correct. In my view, the entire statute contemplates or frames a violation in terms of a conviction or an adjudication or finding of not guilty by a mental defect or disease.
And sex offense means a violation under 1DB. We're back to violation under B. But under G, 1G, under coverage, it talks about a conviction. Your argument is under 301.45 and under 973.048, you have to have a conviction of violating a sex statute.
That's correct, Your Honor. Under the Austin case, a defendant does not plead to the sex offense case. He's not convicted of it. He's not sentenced on it. There's a legal recognition that he admits the conduct. And he himself doesn't even need to admit it. His lawyer can simply say, yes, I agree that it's dismissed and read in. The defendant does not even have to do that.
Well, suppose it wasn't a read-in, but that the pre-sentence report would indicate that his family and friends know that he's committed umpteen other acts, and they report it. Can the sentencing judge take that into account in sentencing?
Well, I guess that depends what that means, take that into account in terms of sentencing.
Give him a heavier sentence for this one, but still within the maximum. Same thing as a read-in. Does it matter whether it's a read-in or not a read-in?
Well, a read-in certainly is going to be viewed as an aggravating factor, but I don't think under those circumstances the judge could order registration.
I didn't ask you that. I asked you whether or not the judge can take it into account in sentencing.
Absolutely, a judge can take into account a read-in.
Read-in, yes. What about just a lot of hearsay, saying he did this, that, and the other thing?
Right, correct, no.
When a judge
asks Mr. Castle, and then my next question will be to him, if you can take it into account when you put it under the register.
When a judge counsel takes into consideration a read-in for purposes of sentencing, does that mean that the defendant has been sentenced on the read-in offense?
No, I think the case law is clear on that. The defendant is not sentenced on the read-in offense.
Okay, I'd like to take a little different approach here. As I read 301.45, which is the sex offender registration statute, that describes who is covered, in other words, who is required to register by operation of law. And as I read 973.048, that pertains to who can be required to register by order of a court, right?
Okay.
And this defendant is not covered by 301.45. He's not required to register by operation of law.
Correct.
Because he doesn't fall within the parameters of that statute. He wasn't convicted or adjudicated on a sex offense.
Correct.
So we're looking at whether the court can order him to register, and that is determined by the language of 973.048, setting aside the general probation statute for the moment. That statute, as I read it, in 1M and 2M, requires that the defendant be sentenced or placed on probation for one of the enumerated sex offenses before the courts can order sex offender registration.
That's correct, and I make that argument in my brief that the defendant was not sentenced for that offense. He was not placed on probation for that offense, and by virtue of that, he cannot be ordered to register under the statute that the court...
So regardless of whether he admitted to a violation of a sex offense in connection with the read-ins, which were dismissed and read in for consideration at sentencing, he was not, using the terms of the statute, sentenced or placed on probation for a violation of one of the enumerated sex offenses.
That's exactly correct. I think that's consistent with the Austin case.
And then the only remaining argument to sort of back into it is whether this is permitted under the general probation statute 973.09,
sub 1, which allows the court to impose any condition which appears to be reasonable and appropriate. And, I mean, it's hard to argue with the proposition that where you've got sex offenses read in, it is unreasonable and inappropriate for a judge to place or to order sex offender registration. However, we have the Oakley case, which talks about a condition of probation which essentially increases the defendant's exposure beyond that which would be allowed for revocation of probation, as I read the case. And does this condition of probation, which extends beyond the termination of probation, once this defendant is off paper, he's still under the registration requirement for 15 years, right?
Well, arguably, under the state's proposition, he could be under the registration statute for however long the trial judge wanted him to be.
And so he would be exposed to what penalty for violation of the continuing registration requirements and the continuing updated information requirements and the continuing reporting in requirements? What is the penalty for violation of that?
Well, the statute specifically speaks to the penalties for non-registration. I don't have it specifically on the tip of my tongue, but the statute specifically addresses the penalty, and that's it's prison essentially for non-compliance with the statute.
It's anything from a 9-month misdemeanor to on the low end to I think a class H felony on the high end.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I would also point out that registration is not unique to Wisconsin. That's in virtually every single case, every single state, but a read-in procedure is somewhat unique to Wisconsin.
And what's the penalty for revocation off a bail jumping offense?
The penalty for, I believe that's a Class D felony. I think it's 10 years, Your Honor.
He got how long?
He was placed on probation for a period of 4 years, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Castle, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing today on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. The issue in this case is whether a sentencing court has the authority, either under the General Probation Statute, Section 973.09, or under the Sex Offender Registration Statute, Section 973.048, to order a defendant to register as a sex offender based on sexual assault charges that are read in at sentencing when the charge to which the defendant pled guilty, bail jumping, is not an offense that makes him subject to registration. It is the State's contention, after a little prodding by the Court of Appeals, that the two statutes independently provide that authority.
You're going under both.
Yes. The defendant in this case, Peter Martel, was charged with 7 counts of secondary sexual assault of a child, all involving the same victim. He was also charged with felony bail jumping for violating a no-contact provision of his conditions of release. After the victim proved unwilling to cooperate, the State reached a plea agreement with Martel that provided that he would enter a no-contest sentence to the bail jumping charge, that the sexual assault charges would be dismissed and read in at sentencing, that the State would recommend probation, and that Martel would agree that he undergo sex offender treatment as a condition of that probation. At sentencing, the Court expressed its shock at the dismissal of the multiple sexual assault charges, and also expressed its concern that a bail jumping conviction alone would not adequately warn the public about Martel's aberrant sexual behavior. The Court said that it would have liked to require Martel to register as a sex offender, but it was uncertain whether it could do so absent a conviction or a read-in on a sex offense. But when it realized that there indeed were read-ins of the sexual assault charges, the Court ordered Martel to register as a sex offender as a condition of probation. The Circuit Court identified Section 973.09 as the source of its authority to order Martel to register as a sex offender. In the Court of Appeals, the State citing the Court of Appeals' recent decision in Torpin, argued that the circuit court's authority derived not from Section 97309, but from the sex offender registration statute, 973.048. In its certification, the Court of Appeals suggested that the State was too hasty to disavow Section 973.09 as a source of authority because, in the Court of Appeals' view, its own decision in Torpin was inconsistent with this Court's decision in two other probation cases, Hain and Oakley. The Court of Appeals thus certified two questions of this Court. The first and more general question asked the Court to clarify the legal standard that governs the sentencing court's authority under Section 973.09 when another statute addresses the subject matter of the condition of probation. The second certified question asked this Court to interpret Section 973.048 to determine whether a charge that is read in its sentencing may be a violation for purposes of that statute that allows the Court to order a defendant to register as a sex offender. I'll first look at the specific statute, Section 973.048. That section provides that, quote, if a court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation for any violation, unquote, of the various offenses listed in the statute, the court either may or shall, depending on the offense, require the person to register as a sex offender. The statutory construction question then presented by this case is whether a read-in offense is a violation for which the court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation. The State believes that under this Court's decision in Floyd and the Court of Appeals' decision in Sarkowich, the answer to that question is yes. Both of those cases held, under statutory language comparable to Section 973.048, that a read-in offense may be treated as an offense for which the court is imposing sentence, even though the defendant is not convicted of the read-in. In both Sarkowich and Floyd, the courts considered the unique function of the read-in at sentencing. When a charge is read in, the defendant is deemed as a matter of law to have admitted the conduct charged in the read-in and agrees that the court may consider that conduct at sentencing. In exchange, the defendant receives the assurance that he will not be prosecuted on that charge. In both Sarkowich and Floyd, the courts also looked to the remedial purposes of the respective statutes and concluded that the remedial purposes would be served by construing the statutes to apply to read-ins as well as the offenses for which the defendant was convicted.
Counsel, I want to focus, as you are, on your argument that under 973.048, a read-in equals a violation. That's your premise.
That's correct.
Your premise is also that it's a placement on probation or a sentence.
That he is placed on probation for a violation. Yes.
Now, here, the sexual offense comes under 2M. I think the sexual offense, if I have it right, is 948.02 sub 2.
Correct.
Now, 2M, as distinguished from 1M, 2M requires, the court shall require the person to, it says in the middle, the court shall require the person to comply with reporting requirements under 30145. As I said, that's distinguished from 1M, where the court may require. So it seems to me a logical extension, not even a logical extension, it seems to me your argument means that any time there is a read-in offense that would fall under one of the offenses itemized under 2M, the court has no authority, no leeway. It must order the person to register under 301.45. Is that what you're saying?
I think that is the logical implication of my argument.
So that's what you're saying. I mean, you're not saying it in your brief, and nor is your opposing counsel saying it in your brief, but it seems to me that's what you're really saying. Anytime there's a read-in offense that falls under 2M, whether or not the court wants to, whether or not the court thinks it's wise, whether or not the court believes it's the interest of the public or the defendant, your reading requires the court on a read-in offense that falls under 2M to mandate sexual registration.
You're right. That is
my... Do you really want that? The legislature that wanted it.
I think the question is, in terms of, I think your concern is the absence of discretion.
That's right. That's what your argument mandates. And I'm just asking you, because this isn't played out this way in either of your briefs. Do you really want that?
I think that absence of discretion is the necessary implication, yes.
So I'm in Marathon County, and I have a read-in offense that's one of these listed, and, you know, the DA comes in, and we're pleading to this, and we're pleading to that, and we've got a read-in that's listed here. And then my hands are tied. Okay, he's got to be registered for at least the next 15 years as a sexual registration.
The same as if he were pleading guilty to that offense.
What are the ramifications of that? Do you think it was contemplated by the legislature that any time there's a read-in offense, they have to register?
I can't say whether it was contemplated, and I checked the legislative history and I saw no reference, perhaps not surprisingly, to read-ins.
That's your argument under the plain language of the statute.
Under the language of the statute and under the way comparable statutes have been treated by this Court and the Court of Appeals.
Now, if it wasn't a read-in, can the judge consider the pre-sentencing report that indicates he has committed offenses against children, sexual offenses, in sentencing him for bail jumping?
The judge certainly could take that information into account, yes.
Would it fall under 973-048-2M?
No, I think...
That's where you draw the line.
I think that's where I would draw the line, where because of the unique nature of a read-in and that it, as a matter of law, constitutes an admission and an acknowledgement that it can be considered at sentencing. So that is where I would draw the line.
Following Justice Bradley's line of questioning, there is a little qualifying phrase that follows that. Unless the court determines that the person is not required to comply under 301.45.1M.
Yes, but that's a fairly narrow exception. As I recall, that's an exception involving consensual sexual conduct where
sexual intercourse.
Right. And where the offender is, I think, under 19 or under, and the victim is no more than 4 years.
Well, sub 1G says a person is not required to comply if all of the following apply, and 1G says the violation of the solicitation to commit did not involve sexual intercourse by the use or threat of force or violence with a victim under the age of 12 years.
Right. So as I read that, this is an attempt to carve out from the mandatory reporting requirements certain offenses involving the boyfriend-girlfriend consensual sexual contact or non-forceful sexual intercourse that is a statutory violation regardless of consent, but to say that that is not an offense that requires registration. So
under 1M, every single one of those elements listed in that left-hand column and apparently in the right-hand column have to be met in order for that narrow exception to apply.
That's right. So that is why, in response to Justice Bradley's question about whether there's any discretion, My answer is no, because this is such a narrow carve-out.
So you're going to read this. If a court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation or a violation, paren, which includes a read-in violation of, and then those sections, then the court shall, must do that. And even if the person does not come within the registry coverage. So even under, if you just looked at 301.451G and the other provisions, they talk a violation, but they talk about conviction, right?
I guess there are two possible ways to look at it. One is to say that 973.048 is the specific statute that addresses the sentencing authority. But if you look in 301.451G, who is covered, I think you can, if you look at sub B, applies to a person who is in prison, so on and so on, or is on probation on or after December 25th, 1993 for a sex offense. And if you turn back to the definition of a sex offense, it uses the term violation again.
I'm sorry, what are you referring back to there?
If you refer back, sub 1GB talks about a person who is in prison or on probation for a sex offense. If we turn back to the definition of sex offense in 1D sub B, sex offense means a violation of the enumerated offenses.
But you have to be convicted. Which one on you, what subsection are you going under 1G?
I'm looking at sub B.
Pardon me?
B. If the person is on probation for a violation. If the person is on probation for a sex offense, and the sex offense.
But a defendant is not considered on probation for a read-in offense. Our read-in case law does not stand for that proposition. That's a real stretch as far as I'm concerned.
I would agree with you if it weren't for the way Sarkowitz and Floyd have used read-ins.
But Sarkowitz doesn't contain any language like that. It authorizes an award of restitution as a condition of probation for harms caused to read-in victims, but it doesn't stand for the proposition that the sentence or the probation is for the read-in offense.
Well, the statute at the time of Sarkowitz, the statute was subsequently amended to expressly include read-ins. The language of the restitution statute at the time of Sarkowitz said, when imposing sentence or ordering probation for any crime, the court shall order the defendant to make full or partial restitution to any victim of the crime. So I think that language in Sarkowitz, the crime is referring to the crime for which the court is ordering probation, and the Sarkowitz court said that includes read-ins.
But they actually sentenced on something else.
Right.
So they say that for the read-in, they're going to say you've got to give restitution to the victim of the read-in.
Right.
And but you're saying, therefore, that means they are doing restitution for a read-in. And that comes under the statutory language of restitution for the offense or crime, as you read it. That's your reasoning?
Yes. And similarly, in Floyd, which was involved the sentence credit statute, the statute said that a defendant is entitled to sentence credit for time spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence is imposed, including, and the relevant language is, confinement related to an offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced. Notwithstanding our understanding of deriving from Austin that the defendant is not sentenced on that, this court in Floyd said that for sentence credit purposes, the offense for which the offender is ultimately sentenced includes the time he spent in custody on the read-in charge alone.
Except that operates to the defendant's benefit. Right? In that case.
That's right. In that case. In Sarkwith.
In this case, this condition of probation extends his exposure beyond that which he would otherwise have if he were revoked off of probation on the bail jumping charge. And it does so for a significant period of time.
It exposes him to, that's right, to the requirements of 301.45 for a period of 15 years after his probation. But Sarkwith, the restitution statute, did not operate to the benefit of the defendant either. I mean, I think what all three cases have in common is that they are remedial statutes. Now,
did it increase his exposure on revocation? In Sarkowitz? Prison exposure.
Did it?
No. Did the restitution? Okay, if he violated the restitution order, which was a condition of probation, by not paying it to the read-in victims, he could be revoked.
Sure.
But he was not exposed to any more prison time than he otherwise would be.
No, because
which is the case here.
That's correct.
So this really falls more closely within Oakley.
Well, I think the difference between this case and Oakley is, as I pointed out, 973.048 expressly says that when putting aside the read-in, let's take the case of a person who pleads no contest to second-degree sexual assault of a child, the court places him on probation for 3 years. For that three-year period, and that three-year period alone, he is subject to sentencing, a considerably longer sentencing, if he were revoked for not complying with the condition. But 973.048, because it says the person shall, can be ordered to comply with 301.45, that contemplates that a probationer can both be subject to revocation for noncompliance during the period of revocation and also for the 15-year period afterwards. So I think
except that person has actually been sentenced or placed on probation for a sex offense, which is not the case here.
Well, that's the question. Unless we say under the logic of Sarkowitz and Floyd, the read-in is treated as an offense for which he's being placed on probation. I will candidly admit, but for Sarkowitz and Floyd, I wouldn't be standing here making that argument.
Well, it seems to me, following up on Justice Sykes, when I was reading this, that Floyd, since it deals with the sentence credit, that the difference in exposure, as set forth in Justice Sykes' questions, is really a distinguishing characteristic between Floyd and this case. I'm always taken by the argument that, well, you know, restitution is remedial and, you know, all of these things are benign. And I say to myself, if it's so remedial, then why does it hurt so much, you know? And it's the same kind of thing here. If this difference in exposure, it means something. Now, I know we have cases that say this is all remedial, but boy, if you're opened up to much greater exposure from imprisonment and 15 years of being in the registry, it seems like that falls in between someplace, that it's not purely benign and just all for the benefit of the public.
Well, that's what Bollig says, that it is not a punitive. It certainly imposes
But it's never been used like it's used here, you know, that continues, that exposes someone to much greater period of incarceration.
I mean, but I think it is routinely used like that for any time. Again, putting aside the issue of the read-in, when someone is placed on probation following, say, a guilty plea, that very extended period of exposure kicks in.
Yeah. You set aside the read-in, which is the critical thing here. I mean,
right.
Could the legislature have intended that a read-in offense would subject someone to the sexual registration.
If the legislature was familiar with Sarkowitz, which it is presumed to know the case law, I think it may well be presumed to know.
Was it familiar with what was that other legislation that was passed right before this that specifically addressed whether or not read-ins are included?
The amendment to the restitution statute.
That's right.
Yeah.
If you say, well, the legislature was familiar with Sarkowitz, I think they'd probably be more familiar with some legislation they just passed months before that specifically included read-in offenses.
Right.
They took the effort to include by specific provision a read-in offense. And it seems to me an argument is made that if they wanted to do that here, they could have, but they didn't.
Well, I don't know enough about the timing of the amendment. Clearly what the statutory change to the restitution did is codified. I don't know enough about the timing. Often one will see when there's an issue before the court or working its way up, there will be legislation introduced to cover the possibility that the court will rule the other way. Enough about the timing of the statutory change that followed Sarkowitz to offer an opinion on that. By the same token, though, I don't believe the sentence credit statute has been amended following this Court's decision in Floyd, which one could argue then that the legislature recognizes that it doesn't have to be explicit about including read-ins, that this Court can do it as a matter of statutory construction.
Well, your interpretation of 973.048.2M has to say that the Court has imposed a sentence for violation of a sex act.
Or place the defendant on probation.
Okay. But when they place it on probation, it is a sentence.
They can sometimes withhold a sentence. The sentence can be withheld, as it was in this case. So,
all right. So that you can do it either way. That is, so if he were sentenced here, you'd still say it came under 973.048, or would you say that's different?
Yeah, I would still say that.
But the difference is a conviction, isn't it? I mean, you're placed on probation, excuse me, Chief, but there's a conviction.
Well, in both cases,
there is no conviction.
Yeah, whether the judge imposed and stayed sentence, imposed sentence, or withheld sentence and placed the defendant on probation, I don't think that affects our analysis here at all.
There's no conviction of a sex act.
The conviction is not of a sex act. That's
right,
correct.
But Austin says, under our read-in procedure, the defendant does not plead and therefore is not sentenced on any of the read-in charges.
Right. That language is problematic for us.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's why I'm reading it to you.
Yeah.
If it supported you, I would have read it to the other counsel.
And that's why, excuse me?
Go ahead.
And that's why I say, but for Sarkowitz and Floyd, I would not.
Yeah, except that language I just read from Austin was quoted in Sarkowitz.
That's right.
And apparently with accepting it.
Yeah.
didn't distinguish it,
that's right,
but accepted it. Okay, now that's your argument. Your argument is under the plain language of 973.048, by reading in, read-in, you come under it.
That's right.
That's a good summary of yours. What about the general probation statute, reasonable, necessary, in
right.
light of the fact that to come under the specific?
Right. Well, I think in terms of the factual predicate, I don't think there's any room for argument that it's reasonable and appropriate.
And they didn't debate the condition that he have, was it a sex, I'm sorry, I can't remember.
Sex offender treatment.
Sex offender treatment,
yes.
Right, okay.
So there's no problem, I think, with the factual predicate. I think the question is, and I think the Court of Appeals was correct to the way it framed the issue in the certification. There is a difference. It's a subtle difference, but it is a difference nonetheless between the way the Court of Appeals has looked at the interplay between 973.09 and specific sentencing statutes Court of Appeals has taken the view that if there's a specific sentencing statute that addresses the condition of probation, in effect, that statute occupies the field. So unless it's expressly permitted by the statute, that it is not permitted as a condition of probation. The Court of Appeals, in its certification, said we may have taken the wrong tack, that the approach under Hain, as confirmed by Oakley, is that the probation statute and the other statutes are concurrent and cumulative, and that unless there is something in the specific statute that expressly or specifically prohibits that action by the court, it may be done as a condition of probation. So I think the Court of Appeals was correct to identify that tension between its own line of cases and this Court's decisions.
But doesn't Oakley also stand for the proposition that a condition of probation that operates to increase the defendant's exposure is not allowed?
I don't think it's that general proposition, and I think it says it looks to that statute to see whether it sets an express a specific limit. And the, my argument is that the sex offender registration statutes do not set that a limit, such a limit, because 973.048 expressly recognizes that the court may put a person on probation for a fixed number of years. During that period, he is subject to revocation and whatever perhaps very lengthy penalty for violation of a condition of probation, which would include not complying with a registration.
That, again, is for a person who falls within the express terms of the statute.
That's right.
Assuming that we reject that argument and go to your fallback position, which is the general argument under 973.09,
but
we've said this doesn't apply to him, so.
Well, but the question is, your question was, does the fact that, if I understood it, that 301.45 places, has penalties, the 9-month or 6-year penalties, is that a specific limit? And I think that's independent question of whether the person is being placed on probation because it's a read-in or the offense for which he's convicted. And I'm saying it is not a limit because the statutory scheme recognizes, it is implicit in the statutory scheme that for the initial period that the person is subject to registration, while he's on probation, he can be revoked and for noncompliance with the registration statute, and the penalty for that will be maybe greater than the 9 months or 6 years.
Right. But again, for someone who is expressly covered by 973.048. So, but if we reject that argument and conclude that the defendant is not expressly covered by that and that the only way this is proper is under a construction of 973.09, there's no question but that this condition operates to subject the defendant to a penalty greater than, in addition to, over and above, that which would he would be exposed to for a violation of a condition of probation, in other words, revocation on the bail jumping offense.
Right. And my argument is that that is...
That's not a limitation.
That is not a limitation because inherent in 973.048 is that dual possibility of punishment.
Well, in Oakley, he would get more under violation of probation than he got under the statute.
Converse.
It was the converse thing. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Okay, I see my time is up. Thank you.
Well, I have a question. Help me to understand. There's another condition of probation, and that is that the defendant undergo sex evaluation and follow required treatment. I don't sense that that condition is being objected to.
No, in fact, in the plea agreement, the defendant expressly consented to that. It's, if you look on the...
But that's a consensual.
That is consensual. That's correct.
What would happen if the defendant violated that condition of probation?
He would then be subject to revocation and sentencing on the bail jumping charge with a maximum 10-year penalty.
So is it a matter of whether the defendant consents to a condition of probation? I mean, would they argue that?
It would certainly be a very different matter if the defendant had consented to the registration requirement, but I don't think the absence of his consent makes it impossible for the court to impose it.
On the other hand, the state could have made consent to sex registration part of the plea agreement, couldn't they?
It could have. It did not in this case, and the defendant would have been free to not agree to plead under that term. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Casson. Counsel?
I'd like to address Floyd very briefly and distinguish that from this case in terms of a read-in. In Floyd, the issue was sentence credit. I would distinguish that case from our situation in that in Floyd, the down case or the negative competing interest was very low. If a trial court decided to give a defendant some additional credit that he may not have been entitled to, well, so be it. There's not a huge downside to that in terms of extending the credit to read-in. But in this case, if a trial court extends the read-in to force someone to register as a sex offender, there's a huge downside to that. They're obviously faced with a significant prison exposure, not only in Wisconsin, but in other states as well. They're going to be tagged with that registration when they travel to other states. As to how another state would interpret a Wisconsin read-in offense, that remains to be seen. I think that's a host of application problems in terms of other law enforcement agencies from other states trying to interpret what a read-in offense in Wisconsin would mean for their own sex offense registry. I think that's problematic. Also, another downside, a person is greatly stigmatized by being on a sex offender registration list. I think that's something that obviously wasn't in Floyd. In terms of the stigmatization, as a practical matter, we're taking non-sex offenders and we're putting them on the sex offender list. Bulletins are going to be posted throughout the community at some point, and I think the bulletin is clear that it specifies a statute and it portrays a person as a convicted sex offender. I think that raises an issue of potential civil liability for a government entity who may incorrectly hold out that this person was a convicted sex offender when in fact he wasn't, and by virtue of some...
He was not convicted, he was just admitted. He was admitted sex offender.
Well, as a factual matter, you're correct, Your Honor. He admitted to that offense being read-in. The legal idea would be the read-in. He admitted to that conduct, but as I pointed out, he specifically would not have had to admit to that.
Why did the defendant concede to undergo sex offender treatment?
Your Honor, in terms of that would be therapy, counseling, treatment. That can be done during a very short time frame, during the term of your probation. It's a much less onerous condition than registration. If a defense lawyer had to sell registration to the client, in this case, he would not have gone with it. But in this case, treatment, therapy, that's a less onerous thing to participate in as a condition of probation. It didn't have the stigmatizing effect. It didn't have the potential penalty involved with it. So it was a completely different ballgame in terms of the condition of probation.
Can a defendant who consents to a read-in of an offense be later prosecuted after that offense is dismissed and read-in?
I would say no to that. The court has already addressed this issue, but I would reinforce that other statutes do provide for read-in offenses, specifically the restitution statute. If the legislature wanted to include a read-in offense as a basis for registration under 301.45, they certainly could have done that, and they would have done that. Again, it's a very detailed, express, specific, precise statute. They had a format and a basis to do that, and they did not. My final point would be in terms of 973-09, again, we would essentially be opening the door to non-sex offenders to be placed on the registration list. I think that's inconsistent with the purpose of the list to serve the community in having a defined list of people who've been convicted of specific offenses, and then to water down that list with people who may have been convicted of shoplifting, of theft crimes, OWI, and they ended up on the list just because the trial court judge felt it was reasonable and appropriate. I think that was not what the legislature contemplated in formulating a sex offender list.
What is the incentive for a defendant to engage in this sort of plea bargaining where offenses are admitted and read in but dismissed?
Well, I think the incentive in terms of the plea bargain arrangement is that the client knows that that won't be used against him, and it's a done deal and over, and he's not looking at future liability in the future. Whereas here, he would, not only in Wisconsin, but in other jurisdictions. I would also point out, my time's up.
You may finish your sentence.
I would point out, based on that line of questioning, however, if a defendant could be ordered to register as a reasonable and appropriate condition, I think that's going to filter down to the trial court level where the prosecutor's note is going to know he can ask for that. He's going to think, I think it's reasonable, appropriate, and I'm going to ask the judge to order that, and I think the judge will go along with that. So that's really going to filter down to plea bargaining negotiations, and I think it's going to have an effect that clearly was not contemplated by the legislature. It's going to be used as a sword, rather a mechanism to protect the public and create this list of enumerated sex offenders. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Zaleski, and thank you, Mr. Castle. This concludes 02-1599 CR State v. Martel. The students will remain here. Anyone else who wishes to hear a discussion among the students and Justice Bradley, welcome to do so. The court will be back in the conference room at 11:35. But before I adjourn the session, we want to say to Justice Babbage, in keeping with our long tradition, that, as I told you earlier, this is his last appearance. We all hope it's your last appearance, because otherwise it means we're going to be having more oral arguments. So we hope it's his last appearance at oral argument. He will, however, participate with the court through July 31st. As those familiar with the court know, we'll be doing petitions for review by then. But we all, on behalf of everyone, all of your colleagues on the bench, Justice Babbage and the people of the state of Wisconsin, and we all wish you a richly deserved retirement. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say that Justice Babbage has been on the court for 20 years, and he noted to the court some time ago that in that entire time, he has only missed one day of oral argument, which he said was when his brother was married, which I guess was a reasonable excuse, but other than that, he hasn't missed any. So.
I'll check the records. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.